This is Jeff Blankford welcoming you to
Takes on the World, a public affairs program that comes your way the second and fourth Wednesdays of every month, and every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phones to get your takes on the world. At 0 hour in Damascus this coming Saturday morning, a complicated agreement.
This is Jeff Blankford welcoming you
to Takes on the World, a public affairs program that comes your way the second and fourth Wednesdays of every month, and every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phones to get your takes on the world. At 0 hour in Damascus this coming Saturday morning, a complicated agreement negotiated between Secretary of State John Kerry and Russian Federation Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov, calling for a cessation of hostilities between Syria's warring parties, those that are not on the international terrorist list, is scheduled to go into effect. The news of this received short shrift on NPR's Morning Edition, as it did from the New York Times and other elements of the mainstream media, who have adopted the neocons' version of the Middle East as smoothly as they did in the run-up to the Iraq War and with coverage of the U.S.-sponsored coup in Iran and Ukraine. Given the tensions between Russia and the United States over Ukraine, it seemed unlikely that the two sides would produce an agreement with almost all the warring parties in Syria that, instead of fighting each other, will focus on defeating the two UN-designated terrorist organizations, the Islamic State or Daesh and Jabhat al-Nusra, the al-Qaeda affiliate in Syria which previously has enjoyed White House backing as well as that of the Saudis and Turkey. The agreement will not be welcomed and is likely to be sabotaged by Turkey and Saudi Arabia, two rogue states that are less concerned with defeating the Islamic State, with which both have collaborated, than overthrowing Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. I had hoped to speak at 20 minutes past the hour with Charles Glass, ABC Middle East correspondent, who is visiting New York from his home in Britain, but we seem to have had a problem with his cell phone number. So unless he calls in, we'll be asking you for your takes on the world. Well, one of the things I had hoped to discuss was a recent article he had in Harper's called Disunited Front, the chaotic underfunded battle against the Islamic State, and get his take on how Monday's agreement may change the current situation. But it looks like we don't get that. Well, in war, truth is the first casualty, or so wrote, we are told, Aeschylus, a Greek dramatist who lived in the 5th century BC. But all evidence suggests the facts meeting an untimely end well before the first shot is fired. The lies that justified the war in Iraq were years in fabrication. Those told about Iran have also been years in the making. If you've watched the debates, both Republican and Democrat, you've heard them repeated as if they were part of a catechism obligatory for the presidential candidates of both parties. The mainstream media does the same, never bothering to provide the evidence against Hezbollah, that much maligned Shia political party and militia that came into existence in response to Israel's invasion of Lebanon in 1982 and after 18 years of struggle finally forced Israel to withdraw its troops in 2000. That invasion was a genuine example of state terror for which Israel, with unconditional U.S. backing, has become infamous in the region. The mainstream media provided a rare moment of truth regarding Syria last Friday when the Boston Globe published an article by Stephen Kinzer, whose reporting on U.S. misadventurism in Central America for the New York Times in the 80s is one of American journalism's finest moments. In the Globe article under the headline, "The Media Are Misleading the Public on Syria," Kinzer wrote, "Coverage of the Syrian war will be remembered as one of the most shameful episodes in the history of American press. Reporting about carnage in the ancient city of Aleppo is the latest reason why. For 3 years, violent militants have run Aleppo," writes Kinzer. "Their rule began with a wave of repression. They posted notices warning residents, quote, 'Don't send your children to school. If you do, we will get the backpack and you will get the coffin,' end quote. Then they destroyed factories, hoping that unemployed workers would have no recourse other than to become fighters. They trucked looted machinery to Turkey and sold it. This month, people in Aleppo have finally seen glimmers of hope. The Syrian army and its allies have been pushing militants out of the city. Last week," noted Kinzer, "they reclaimed the main power plant. Regular electricity may soon be restored. The militants' hold on the city could be ending. Militants true to form, Kinzer write, are wreaking havoc as they are pushed out of the city by Russian and Syrian army forces. Turkish-Saudi-backed moderate rebels shower the residential neighborhoods of Aleppo with unguided rockets and gas jars, one Aleppo resident wrote on social media. The Beirut-based analyst Marwa Osma asked, quote, "The Syrian Arab army, which is led by President Bashar Assad, is the only force on the ground, along with their allies who are fighting ISIS. So you want to weaken the only system that is fighting ISIS?" Well, that does not fit with Washington's narrative, points out Kinzer. As a result, much of the American press is reporting the opposite of what is actually happening. Like you hear today from Alice Fordham in Istanbul, she's getting her information, as she admits, from those fighting the government. She's not there on the ground. Many news reports, writes Kinzer, suggest that Aleppo has been, quote, a liberated zone for 3 years, but now is being pulled back into misery. Americans are being told, writes Kinzer, that the virtuous course in Syria is to fight the Assad regime and its Russian and Iranian partners. We are supposed to hope that a righteous coalition of Americans, Turks, Saudis, Kurds, and the moderate opposition will win. This is kind of convoluted nonsense, but Americans cannot be blamed for believing it. We have almost no real information about the combatants, says Kinzer, their goals or their tactics. Much blame for this lies with our media. Under intense financial pressure, he explains, most American newspapers, magazines, and broadcast networks have drastically reduced their core of foreign correspondents. Much important news about the world now comes from reporters based in Washington. In that environment, access and credibility depend on acceptance of official paradigms. Reporters who cover Syria check with the Pentagon, the State Department, the White House, and think tank experts. After a spin on that soil carousel, Kinzer points out, in the Boston Globe, they feel they have covered all sides of the story. This form of stenography produces a pabulum that passes for news about Syria, end quote, but not on takes on the world. If you want more proof that what is generally referred to as the Israel lobby is pulling the strings of legislators at every political level in the United States, an article distributed by the Jewish Telegraphic Agency yesterday that pointed out that 21 states, nearly half the country, are considering legislation aimed at countering the boycott, divestment, and sanctions, or BDS movement. The article acknowledges that the critics who say some bills are cause for concern, either because they seek to legitimize Israeli settlements or go so far to punish boycott supporters that they infringe on constitutionally protected speech. Two states' legislatures from Illinois and South Carolina last year passed laws mandating that their states divest from companies that boycott Israel. Now, according to the article, 11 additional states, Arizona, California, Colorado, Florida, Georgia, Indiana, Iowa, Massachusetts, New Jersey, New York, and Virginia are considering similar laws. Kansas and Pennsylvania are going further, debating legislation that would defund universities that participate in an Israeli boycott. And another six states are considering or have adopted non-binding resolutions condemning Israel boycotts. Proponents say the trend will intensify this year as pro-Israel activists move to consolidate their gains by pushing laws in states that have already passed non-binding resolutions condemning BDS. Those states see what they're doing now as a follow-up, as a successor, said Eugene Kantorovich, a law professor at Northwestern University who has consulted with groups advancing anti-BDS legislation. In a statement that can only be described as standing the truth and justice on their heads, Kantorovich added that, quote, they're implementing laws that use state contracting power to fight back against racism, end quote. I guess that's when it's being done by Israel and supporters against Palestinian Arabs. It's okay. Critics of the anti-boycott legislation describe the push as a stealth maneuver to reverse nearly 50 years of U.S. policy of not recognizing the legitimacy of Israeli settlements. The article quotes Americans for Peace Now, the U.S. affiliate of Israel's Peace Now, as saying that 19 of the anti-BDS laws that have been proposed since 2014 extend penalties to those targeting only West Bank settlements. A bill adopted by the Indiana House of Representatives in January, for example, requires a state pension fund to divest from companies that participate in a boycott of businesses based in Israel or territories controlled by the Jewish state of Israel, end quote. Not surprisingly, the bill from New York, one of Israel's most important occupied territories, adopted by its state senate in January and scheduled for a third reading in assembly, extends protections to Israeli settlements. Moreover, the bill requires, on the taxpayer's dime, that the state make a list of persons deemed to be engaging in a boycott who would then be rendered ineligible to do business with the state of New York. Meanwhile, in occupied Washington, President Obama reportedly is expected to sign the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, or TTIP, a trade agreement with the European Union in which agents of Israel and Congress inserted a provision that contravenes longtime U.S. policy by recognizing the West Bank Jewish-only settlements as being part of Israel. As passed by Congress, the U.S. will punish any European company that boycotts products produced in the settlements which the U.N. and most of the nations, including the United States, consider to be illegal. In London last week, Prime Minister David Cameron's government, hoping to stem the growth of the boycott sanctions and investment movement there, made it illegal for any government-funded institution to engage in any anti-Israel activities. Monday, he had his response. According to the Times of Israel, the story was ignored here, of course, millions of Londoners were exposed to a series of anti-Israel posters on the underground network to mark the beginning of the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement's 12th annual Israel Apartheid Week. The Jewish Chronicle in Britain, quoted Transport from London, which is responsible for what the Brits refer to as the tube service, as saying this was, quote, an act of vandalism, end quote, that the ads were not authorized and staff members were working to take them down. The posters, designed in the style of BBC reports, attacked the UK Broadcasting Service for biased pro-Israel reporting and claimed Israel used British arms to, quote, massacre Palestinians during 2014 Operation Protective Edge in Gaza. A third poster criticized the global security company G4S for working in Israel, while a fourth, titled Apartheid is Great, Britain, alleged that more than 100 UK companies continue to supply military equipment to the Jewish state. The Jewish Chronicle estimated that the ads appeared on some 500 trains. You rarely, if ever, read about these events in the U.S. mainstream media or hear about them on CNN, Fox News, MSNBC, or NPR, such news being limited, it seems, to the Israeli and American Jewish media. So unless you're plugged into that, you'll be unaware that a large multi-day joint exercise between the Israel Defense Forces and the U.S. European Command officially got underway on Sunday. According to the IDF spokesman's unit, as reported by the Jewish News Service, the goal of the exercise, named Juniper Cobra 16, is to improve cooperation and coordination between the two militaries and bolster ballistic missile defense capabilities, end quote. More than 1,700 U.S. soldiers, civilians, and contractors traveled to Israel to take part in the exercise. Juniper Cobra exercises are held every 2 years, and this year's marks the eighth since the first one was held in 2001. During the current exercise, the American and Israeli participants are training via computer simulations on how to deal with missile and rocket attacks. The various components of Israel's multi-tiered aerial defense network, paid for by American taxpayers, including the Iron Dome, David Sling, and Arrow systems, are part of the exercise. According to the Israel spokesperson's unit, that's right, they have a special unit trained in official speak, this exercise provides an opportunity for both militaries for joint learning and training. The exercise is another step in strategic relations between Israel and the U.S., and it will greatly contribute to regional stability, unquote. Contributing to regional stability, the U.S. or Israel? Who is he or she kidding? They apparently have to put such ludicrous statements on paper, since no one, even an Israeli spokesperson steeped in lying, could repeat such nonsense with a straight face. And needless to say, despite all these joint exercises, not a single Israeli soldier has participated in any U.S. military action in the Middle East. Well, it rated only filler space in the New York Times international section and nothing at all in NPR. But a week ago Tuesday, Washington's puppet prime minister in the Ukraine, Arseniy Yatsenyuk, barely survived a no-confidence vote in the country's parliament following what Newsweek described as a, quote, a harrowing assessment of his term in office by Ukrainian President Petro Poroshenko. Poroshenko, whose party rules in coalition with Yatsenyuk's party, issued a statement claiming that 70% of the population had lost faith in the Yatsenyuk government and a, quote, a full reboot was necessary. Lawmakers took turns taking shots at Yatsenyuk's record, accusing him of corruption, failed economic policies, and inability to complete promised projects such as a planned $225 million wall on the Russian border. Maybe you should contact Donald Trump for that one. Anyway, listen to my last program. We'll recall that Yatsenyuk was the choice of U.S. Deputy Secretary of State and former Hillary Clinton press spokesperson Victoria Nuland Kagan to lead the new pro-American Ukrainian government after last year's coup, and that I played a recording of Nuland Kagan telling a group of Ukrainian-American businessmen that Washington had spent $5 billion trying to overthrow the then-current Ukrainian government. Finally, I feel the need to say a word about the late Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia, who has been widely hailed as, quote, a towering figure, unquote, in the 30 years he served on the nation's highest court. Even President Obama, whose right to appoint a successor mandated by the Constitution, is being challenged by the leadership of the Republicans in the Senate, and the GOP's gaggle of presidential candidates referred to Scalia as towering. Curious, when it should have been clear from Scalia's strict interpretation of the Constitution that he considers Obama and African-Americans to be only three-fifths of a man, and that, like the country's founders, only for the purposes of a census and not as someone qualified to vote. An exaggeration? An unfair criticism of someone described as one of the court's legal minds? Greatest legal minds? Not at all. His leading the court and overturning the landmark piece of civil rights legislation, the 1965 Voting Rights Act in 2013, after it had been renewed by overwhelming margins in both the Senate and the House, was the act of a white supremacist, a white racist, which Scalia was. In arguing against the legitimacy of the act, Scalia warned against, quote, a phenomenon that's called perpetuation of racial entitlement. It's been written about, he said. Whenever a society adopts racial entitlements, it is very difficult, said Scalia, to get out of them through the normal political processes. And I am fairly confident it will be reenacted in perpetuity unless, said Scalia, a court can say it does not comport with the Constitution. And so the Supreme Court, under the thumb of Scalia, did just that by a 5-4 decision, without acknowledging that the primary example of a society adopting racial entitlements to its detriment was our very own, and it was enshrined in our Constitution for all the world to see, but most of whom have forgotten.
This is Jeff Blankford. Thank you for listening.